Earth, this is Gary, and this is I'll Have a Beer and Talk, a podcast in which I enjoy a craft beer and I tell you about interesting stories that I read on my tech blogs. Yes, the show has returned! I am back from a very long, very unexpected hiatus. Everything is fine, I'm fine, you're fine, we're all fine here now, thank you. Day job is good, cats are good, chickens are good, wife is good. We just celebrated our 20th anniversary. I let my beard grow out, got a haircut, and yeah, lots of stuff has happened over the past 8 months. The less I talk about that, the less I'll think about it. Oh, and I should mention that we have moved out of the IHAPAT bunker, and I am now coming to you from an undisclosed location somewhere in the Mount Hood National Forest. Ooh. I am literally in a cabin in the woods, so if things sound a little bit different, and I've been gone so long you probably won't even notice, but it's because I'm in an all-nude recording environment. I mean, all-new recording environment. I am wearing pants. Anyway, let's get this party started and figure out what I'm drinking this episode, huh? Let me just see if I can get the randomizer going here. It's a thing that helps me... randomly selected craft beer each episode, so should have result in a second. Hooray, it's chosen. And thanks to modern miracle randomization science, I shall be drinking Unveiled Brewing Company's brown ale, a 5.6% ABV American brown ale. It's a good name for it. Brown ale. According to BeerAdvocate.com, American brown ales have, quote, roasted malt, caramel-like, and chocolate-like flavor aspects, and are inspired by English-style brown ales and porters. Sounds like a perfectly cromulent beer, and hey, it's a bear in the woods. You know what they do. They drink beer. Let me switch to the beer mic so I can give this a taste. All right, it is a perfectly brown ale with a tan head. Doesn't have much of a smell, which is not necessarily bad. It has a very, very subtle woodsy aroma. It's kind of hard to describe if you've never been in a cabin in the woods for a couple days, but that's kind of what it reminds me of. And hopefully it won't taste like trees. Here we go. Oh, that is nice. Very beautiful, like kind of a chocolatey caramel slide as you get right into it. Tasty. I am a worldly man, so I occasionally read the MIT Technology Review, because I'm smart. S-A-R-T. And I'm glad I did this week, because I now know that machine learning is making pesto even more delicious than it already is. Yes! A study was published in PLOS One, the result of research done by MIT Media Lab's Open Ag Group and colleagues at the University of Texas at Austin. Basil, which, as you should know, is where pesto comes from, was grown in hydroponic units housed in modified shipping containers, which were located in Middleton, Massachusetts, in case you were wondering for some reason. Environmental conditions inside the containers, such as light, temperature, humidity, etc., was automatically controlled, as the basil presumably had the time of its life up until the point it was harvested. Researchers would test the basil taste scientifically, not using their tongues, but by using a gas chromatograph and mass spectrometry to look for certain compounds. The data collected was then fed into machine learning algorithms developed by MIT and a company called Cognizant. That's like the word cognizant, but spelled with a Z. Web 2.0 of them. The resulting data spat out back by the machine. Basil plants exposed to light 24 hours a day were the best tasting basil ever. Hyperbole added by me. Now, this research wasn't just trying to figure out how to make delicious pesto. The goal is to learn how to increase plant yields. And not just for eating plants, but for medicine making plants too. As well as trying to see how plants react to how the global climate is changing, and an attempt to see if we can give them some help in continuing to grow to nourish ourselves so we don't go extinct. We're really interested in building network tools that can take a plant's experience, its phenotype, the set of stresses it encounters, and its genetics, and digitize that to allow us to understand the plant-environment interaction, said Caleb Harper, head of the MIT Media Lab's Open Ag Group, in a press release. I do think they should ball at pesto, though. Sell it as a scientifically proven delicious pesto. and call it exactly that. Or SPDP, if they want to be cool. Isn't human ingenuity awesome? Too bad cultural ingenuity isn't quite as sophisticated. The Verge reports that Queensland, Australia, as of March 1st, will allow Queensland drivers to personalize their vehicle's license plates with emoji. Yes, the new image-based language every teen is communicating with. The state's official license plate vendor, Personalized Plates Queensland, already offers a pretty reasonable amount of personalization options. Normal, understandable ones, such as colors, themes, sportsing team logos, etc. So why emoji? Really? Spokesperson for the Royal Automobile Club of Queensland, Dr. Rebecca Michael, told 7 News Brisbane, "For quite some time, we've seen that you can support your favorite team or your favorite town with a symbol on your number plate." And yes, this is how I imagine Dr. Michael sounds like. "And using an emoji is no different." Okay. Drivers that wish to emoji up the number plates have some restrictions. The plates can't all be emoji. They have to have some letters and numbers in there. And they have limited the emoji set to just 5 out of the 2,823 emojis that are officially recognized. That's the real total. I looked it up. What are these 5 emojis? I'm sure you're not even wanting to know right now. I'll tell you anyway. They are a face with tears of joy, also known as the crying laughing emoji, sunglasses emoji, winking emoji, smiling emoji, and heart eyes emoji. Really, they couldn't also have cat heart eyes emoji? It's one of my favorites. Prices for these new plates with emojis start at $475 Australian dollars, which is the equivalent of $340 American dollars. The emoji option has Queensland Law Society President Bill Potts a little riled up, as he told the Brisbane Times. "Clearly, the government is trying to sex up number plates with a view to making more money, and I can understand that. And yes, I believe Bill has a constantly shifting accent. But the purpose of number plates is for the police to be able to identify vehicles. How do you write down the emoji in your number plate after an accident?" Wow, it's a global shifting accent. Valid points, although I agree with The Verge. Remembering sunglasses, heart eyes, wink would be a lot easier to remember than, like, F25YG7, so... whatever, it's the new language. Switching gears entirely, remember how I mentioned at the top of the show that I'm now in a cabin in an undisclosed location somewhere in the Mount Hood National Forest? It's true, there's a nice creek and waterfall about 20 feet from the front door. And, according to Mashable, that wild nature right out there could be a boon for my stress and anxiety levels. Scientists have known about a connection between spending time in nature and well-being for a while, but really don't know how long or how often one should hang out in the great outdoors to get a little mental refresh. A new study published in the very dynamic-sounding journal Frontiers in Psychology was run to attempt to define that time. They asked participants to go out to a place that, quote, brings a sense of contact with nature, end quote, for at least 10 minutes, 3 times a week, over 8 weeks. They found that participants who spent at least 20 minutes somewhere where they felt a, quote, sense of contact with nature, per excursion, experienced a significant decrease in cortisol, which is also known as the stress hormone. This study is the first tentative reach for having a defined, quote, nature prescription that could be offered to stressed out patients instead of the standard barrage of anxiety medications. Figuring out the right dose of the great outdoors is extremely difficult, as modern science has no idea what outdoor elements are causing the reduction in cortisol levels. Is it the rocks? The trees? The air? The swamp? The ship? I don't know. The study took an adaptive management approach in that they let their 36 participants decide on their own where, when, and how long they spent their minimally required time in a, quote, sense of contact with nature, with a few restrictions. No use of phones or internet-connected devices during nature time, and they could not engage in any aerobic exercise. The researchers had to collect saliva samples for measuring the cortisol, and they also measured the hormone amylase, the levels of which can be influenced by physical activity. So no running around outside, just sitting down and being one with the trees. They found the choose-your-own-nature-adventure aspect of the study was also very important. If a stressed individual also has a fear of forests, having a doctor tell them to go camping for the weekend to de-stress wouldn't really work out that well. On a more generalized, go somewhere outside that has trees for X amount of time, that would work. Hey, if this pans out, that would mean more green spaces everywhere to get everyone to stop being so stressed out all the time. That's good. And where there's green spaces... there's beer gardens. Just saying. Hey there, were you aware that this show's sponsor is Portland's only community handmade papermaking studio? I am talking about Pulp and Deckel. And its mission is to keep the art of papermaking alive with workshops, demonstrations, creating and selling beautiful handmade paper products, and working with artists in creating all styles of art through the medium of papermaking. Browse the rotating selection of papermaking workshops, inquire about custom orders, take an online recycled papermaking class, and check out all the amazing things we do with the ancient art of papermaking by visiting pulpanddeckel.com. That is pulpanddeckle.com. Mention I'll have a beer and talk, and we might even give you something special. Hey, if you live in the suburbs around Seattle and you hear this sound, take cover! Trash will start falling from the sky! Yes, bald eagles are tired of all the American trash laying around and aren't afraid to let you know it, according to Boing Boing. Well, not really. Turns out the bald Seattleite eagles have been scrounging around the Cedar Kills Regional Landfill in King County, searching for deliciousness mixed in amongst all the refuse and flying off with it, only to drop any non-food items after taking flight. Items such as a blood-filled biohazard container that ended up in a nearby resident's yard recently. Great. The open-air landfill was meant to have been closed years ago, but a proposed expansion of the landfill means it will remain an open-air trash pile until the year 2040. Obviously, the residents are, well, pissed. They would love it if the county would cancel the expansion plans, but as we all know, you can't fight City Hall, especially when dump trucks full of cash are involved, followed by dump trucks full of trash. Alternately, residents are trying to figure out some anti-eagle countermeasures, but as to what those will be, they haven't the faintest clue. Poor people. For now, they'll just have to take cover whenever they hear. Hate mosquitoes? Sure, we all do. Hate dubstep? Well, you may want to suffer through it to mess up mosquitoes' lives. Boing Boing, yes, Boing Boing again, reports that famed dubstepper Skrillex's track Scary Monsters and Nice Sprites, quote, reduces mosquitoes' success in foraging, host attack, and sexual activities of Aedes aegypti, the mosquito that spreads dengue fever, chikungunya, Zika fever, meiero, and other nasty diseases that are really hard for me to pronounce. I should have looked them up before recording, but here we are. Published in the exotic-sounding journal Acta Tropica, researchers from the University of Malaysia Sarawak state that exposing the mosquitoes to electronic music, like the Skrillex track I mentioned before, attacked hosts much later than their non-exposed peers, and the occurrence of blood-feeding activity was also lower when music was being played, and, best of all, the mosquitoes copulated it far less often than their counterparts kept in an environment where there was no music. All those things mean less mosquitoes bugging you. Hooray. So let's play a tiny bit of this track, and I'm going to have to talk over it so I don't get a cease and desist letter from Warner Brothers Music. So, yep. Yeah, that sounds like dubstep. Yep. Very, very Skrillex. I'm going to just kind of turn that down now. Well, yeah. Okay. It's going away. Okay. Sorry. Kind of like the music, and I kind of don't at the same time. Maybe I don't like it because I'm a mosquito? Mansquito? I'll have to look into that. Anyway, I like these stories, finding non-chemical mosquito deterrents, especially cheap ones like this. Imagine, in the future, there are no mosquito bites. Not because everything smells of citronella, but because all you hear all around you every summer night is dubstep. And what a horrible, horrible future that will be. Ever hear about the mystery of the French beach and novelty Garfield telephones? Probably not. Gizmodo reports that since the 80s, plastic Garfield telephones have been washing up on the sandy beaches of Brittany. Even 200 pieces were found and collected as recently as last year. The distinct orange plastic shells have become so associated with ocean pollution that the R. Valensu anti-litter group recently began using the phone as an emblem of beach pollution in the region, according to France Info. But where have these totems of a lasagna-loving, Monday-hating cat been coming from for all of these years? A man by the name of René Morvan knows, and he's let slip the secret to France Info. In the early 1980s, when René was about 19 or 20 years old, a big storm hit the area. After the storm passed, René and his brothers were exploring sea caves that are only accessible during low tide. Inside one of them, they discovered a large cargo container wedged in the rocks. Can you guess what was in that container? Socks? Nope, it was Garfield phones. Renee brought journalists and some Ara Valensu representatives to the cave, and they found parts of the container buried in the crag and phone bits everywhere, scattered around and stuck between rocks. The mystery is solved, Dominique, an Ara Valensu volunteer, told France Info. We have found our treasure. And now we come to the closing funny and or weird animal story. And it's about cats. Yay, cats! Cats. Gizmodo reports that scientists talk to cats to figure out if they know their own name. Published in Science Advances, researchers at Sophia University in Tokyo, Japan, wanted to see if cats respond to their given names. Now, it's already been explored scientifically if cats can recognize human gestures. They can. Facial expressions. They can. Vocal cues. They can. And they are capable of recognizing their human cohabitator's voice. But do cats acknowledge that the names we call them by are, well, their names? Atsuko Sato, lead author of the study that showed that cats are capable of recognizing specific human voices, led the new study that involved observing 78 cats in Japanese households and in cat cafes. If you are unaware, cat cafes are coffee shops that are also home to multiple cats in a shared environment. You can have coffee and hang out with kitties. Some are even act as adoption centers, which is really awesome. There's one in Portland that almost closed but has reopened with new ownership. So, gotta visit that sometime. Might make my cats jealous, but anyway, tangent. Back to the story. The study was structured to have a key component, habituation. Habituation occurs when a psychological or emotional response fades in intensity after repeated exposure to certain specific stimuli. Kind of like how children like to repeat the word mom over and over again, and their mother ends up completely ignoring them by the time that the children are age 5. Anyway, names are not considered something that can be habituated to. It is what is called a salient stimulus. For cats, that means their name is probably a stimulus for rewards, like a tasty treat, or pets. Or punishments, like get off the counter, name, followed by being pushed off the counter, or a strong no, name, when kitties scratch the couch. The new study consisted of 4 different experiments in which either the cat's human cohabitator or a researcher spoke a string of 4 different words in the presence of a cat, followed by the cat's name. The 4 words were general nouns featuring similar lengths and accents, including the names of other cats, intended for the subject cats to habituate to. The subject cat's own name was considered the dishabituation stimuli, the word that they would always have a reaction to. The researchers wrote, if the cats were habituated to the other 4 words and dishabituated to their own names, a rebound response to the presentation of their own names would be observed, indicating the ability to discriminate their own names from other words. Basically, the cats would be completely disinterested in anything said until they heard the sound of their own name. That sounds a lot like a certain political figure. Anyway, when the cat's name was spoken, the researchers looked for defined behavioral responses, specifically ear moving, head moving, tail moving, vocalizing, and changing locations. The responses were given points to determine how much of a reaction the cat would have. Each of the 5 responses were worth 0.5 points, with a possible maximum kitty response score of 2.5. Okay, the 4 experiments were as follows. Testing the ability of household cats to discriminate their own names from the general nouns. Testing the ability of cats who regularly live with at least 4 other cats to discriminate their own names from the names of the other cats. A repeat of the second test, but with general nouns instead of cat names. And testing to see if cats can discriminate their own names from general nouns when uttered by persons unfamiliar to them. The second and third experiments included cats from the cat cafe. The results? Cats are able to distinguish their own name, even when said by a human unfamiliar with them. All cats could tell the difference between rando sounds and their names. Household cats that shared the house with other cats could tell their names from those other cats. But the cafe cats were not so good at discerning their name from the names of the other cafe cats. This is probably something to do with the cafe environment itself, possibly just too many cats and no real reinforcement of the given names of the kitty residents. Who knows? The study, while interesting and completely believable for cat cohabitator humans such as myself, there has been some criticism that the study cherry-picked their data. Mikel Delgado from the Department of Medicine and Epidemiology at UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine Told Gizmodo that, quote, if you look at all the data, the number of cats who respond to their name is pretty small. Generally, only 1/3 to 1/2 of cats showed an increased response to their name, which isn't exactly mind-blowing. She also pointed out that the observed behavior scores were a little generous compared to the dummy trials' scores. Still, Delgado did point out that the researchers were careful to match the way the cats' names are spoken to what they are used to, saying, quote, most of us, when we call our cats names, don't do so in a monotone. We often use more of what is called mother ease, a higher pitch that animals tend to respond to more. Which is totally true. Our cats' names are Ben and Paxton, which we usually pronounce as Ben and Paxton. Anyway, cool stuff. And as I said, having cohabitated with cats for pretty much every year of my life, I can say it's all true. They definitely know their names. You know, all this talk about cat names reminds me of a poem by T.S. Eliot called The Naming of Cats, which I originally learned about when I saw the film Logan's Run, because Peter Ustinov quoted from it. So if you'll indulge me, The Naming of Cats by T.S. Eliot. The naming of cats is a difficult matter. It isn't just one of your holiday games. You may think at first, I am as mad as a hatter, when I tell you a cat must have 3 different names. First of all, there's the name that the family uses daily, such as Peter, Augustus, Alonzo, or James, such as Victor, or Jonathan, George, or Bill Bailey. All of them sensible, everyday names. There are fancier names if you think they sound sweeter. Some for the gentlemen, some for the dames. Such as Plato, Admetus, Electra, Demeter. But all of them sensible, everyday names. But I tell you, a cat needs a name that's particular. A name that's peculiar and more dignified. Else how can he keep up his tail perpendicular, or spread out his whiskers, or cherish his pride? Of names of this kind, I can give you a quorum, such as Munkustrap, Quaxo, or Coracopat, such as Bombalariuna, or else Jellylorum. Names that never belong to more than one cat. But above and beyond, there's still one name left over, and that is a name you will never guess. The name no human research can discover. But the cat himself knows, and will never confess. When you notice a cat in profound meditation, the reason I tell you is always the same. His mind is engaged in a rapt contemplation of the thought of the thought of the thought of his name. His ineffable, effable, effin' ineffable, deep and inscrutable, singular name. Did you know that this show is not only supported by Pulp and Deckel, but it is supported by loyal listeners just like you? If you enjoy the show, want to feel like you're a part of it all, I've got 3 options for you. You can always hire me for some voice and audio production work. I can do voicemail messages, mediocre acting, bad singing, and some adequate audio production. I actively edit and produce the show, and I edit the Paper Talk podcast. You should really check that one out. It's really cool. If you feel you or someone you know might have a best use for the best part of my body, which happens to be my voice and my brain, let me know. Email me at gary@pulpanddeckel.com. That is G-A-R-Y at P-U-L-P-A-N-D-D-E-C-K-L-E.com. Rates are reasonable. And hey, if you thinking about making a podcast and you have questions, hey, I can totally tell you what I've learned for a reasonable price. And hey, if you could find it within your heart to favorably rate and review this show on iTunes, that'd be swell. That way some people scouring iTunes for podcasts might notice that there's a party going on over here and everyone is invited. And you know what? You can also support the show with money. I know, how droll, but it helps. If you enjoy what you're hearing each episode, you can donate at least $1 a month to the show at patreon.com/iHabitRadio. And you can be my patron. Go to patreon.com/iHabitRadio. Let me spell it out for you. It is patreon.com/iHabitRadio. If you do become my patron, you'll be joining a very attractive and intelligent group that already support me there. That $1 goes a really long way, and it is very, very deeply appreciated. Thank you, listeners. Ah, the wonderful caramely brown ale is now done and in my belly. Delicious. And that means it's time for me to go. but I will be back a lot sooner than 8 months from now. Trust me. Please tell your family, friends, neighbors, pets, plants, aliens, and forest creatures that the show is back and that they can find it on Google Play Music, on iTunes, on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and on Spreaker. And please send me feedback, story suggestions, and beer recommendations to gary@pulpandtackle.com or on the Twitters and Instagram at iHabitRadio or even on the Facebook at facebook.com/iHabitRadio. It's time for me to go. I will see you in the future. Bye-bye!